When I was with you last, a couple of weeks ago, we had just started into the Ten Commandments and consider together the very first one in Exodus 20 and verse 2. I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and therefore, verse 3, first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. And that was our focus when we began this chapter. And as you see there, that commandment prohibits the worship of anyone else except for Yahweh, the only one true and living God. And we dealt at some length with the significance of that commandment, particularly within the context of the world that the people of Israel were living in at that time. That verse laid a foundation for a unique emphasis in the Old Testament on what we call monotheism. And that is the truth that there is only one God. He alone should be worshipped because he is the only actual God that exists. And that was also the foundation for all the other commandments that we find in this list. And it sets the tone for the direction of the obedience of God's people, that even though some of these things got down into the weeds of their daily relationships and decisions, it was all an outflow. It was to be an outflow of their worship of this one true God. And as we continue, you may be aware of the fact that the way that these commandments break down, the first four of them have mostly to do with that worshipful relationship and what is involved in directly showing love and adoration to the Lord. And then the rest of it, the other six, have to do with how that fleshes itself out in horizontal type relationships as people are interacting with each other and striving to love their neighbor in addition to, or as a way of showing love to God, loving their neighbor is expressed in those other six commandments. And so we're still talking in a very focused way about the issue of worship when we come to the second commandment, and it begins in verse 4. And I'll read for us here Exodus 20, verses 4 to 6. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, Yahweh, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now, as you read those words, it's obvious that the commandment in verse 4 and verse 5 rules out the worship of images that represented the pagan gods that would have been recognized by the cultures around the people of Israel. Some of these I named for you as we were working through the story about the plagues. You could think, for example, of some of those Egyptian gods like the sun god Amun-Re, or in terms of where the people of Israel were heading into the land of Canaan. You can think of the various gods that are associated with the worship of Baal in that particular part of the world. So clearly, words like we find in Exodus 20, 4 and 5 would put that kind of thing off limits, bowing down before an image that represented a false god. And actually, to help us appreciate just how relevant this commandment still is, we need to recognize that such forms of idolatry continue to exist today. People around the world are still bowing down to images of gold and wood and metal and stone as a way of honoring the gods that they embrace. In fact, the degradation that is connected with that sort of pagan idolatry is one of the urgent realities that has motivated the modern missionary movement. We support missionaries who minister in cultures where the kind of thing going on in the ancient Near East is still going on today. I want to read for you some from the biography of the one who's recognized as the father of modern missions, and his name is William Carey. He, of course, was raised up of the Lord to go to India. I'm going to read for you some from his biography from a period pretty early in his ministry. And I share this with you because even though this is from a much later context, the detail that he gives is very much like the kind of thing that would have been the experience of the people of God living in the culture at the time that Moses gave the law. We read this, at April's full moon, all the Sundarban world flocked to Devata in the dinghies and barges for the Krishna Mela, which was a religious fair, the Dolgatra, or the Saturnalia of India. Not less than 10,000, Carey says, gathered. For from the days of Gokul Ananda, whose tomb is still hallowed, it had possessed a temple where Radha and Krishna were worshipped. In this Saturnalia of India, the images of Radha and Krishna are carried into the open, and amidst the shoutings of the people are gently swung in cradled swings at dawn, at noon, at eve, to see which is, quote-unquote, great merit. Into a bonfire is flung the effigy of a legendary demon. The people scatter handfuls of red powder over one another and syringe one another with the same in rival groups. Often they abandon themselves to coarse gesture, dance, and song. In their circuit of Debata, Mr. Short allowed their dance upon his lawn, and the crowd thronged the space between the bungalow and the river. But to Carey, especially as it was Sunday, the buffoonery and the din were, quote-unquote, hell. Now it gets even more graphic. That same month he saw for the first time fakirs, Hindu begging monks, flinging themselves upon spikes from considerable height, tearing their flesh and bones. Also he observed the frenzied dancing, and as a hideous climax, the grotesque hook swingings, which he thus describes. And these are people offering worship to their gods. The man who is to swing prostrates himself before a tree, and a person makes a mark with his dusty fingers where the hooks are to be put. Another immediately gives him a smart clap on one side of the back and pinches up the skin hard with his thumb and fingers, while another passes the hook through, taking hold of about an inch of skin. The other hook is in the like manner skin of the other side of the back, and the man gets up on his feet. Does this sound a little bit like the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel cutting themselves? He then mounts on him. As he rises, water is thrown in his face. He then mounts on a man's back or on some other eminence, and the strings attached to the hooks are tied to the rope at one end of a horizontal bamboo. And the rope at the other end is held by several men who, drawing it down, raise up the end on which the man swings, and by their running round with the rope, the machine is turned. In swinging, the man describes a circle of about 30 feet diameter and scatters herbs already offered to Siva, one of their gods, and perhaps smokes his hookah or pipe as he whirls. I saw one swing thus for a quarter of an hour. These hook swingings involved only men of the lowest castes, bird catchers, tanners, shoemakers, and so on, but great crowds thronged to watch. To Carey, it was all so repulsive and pitiful that he pledged his life afresh to give India the gospel of Christ. This was the kind of darkness that existed in that age, and it's quite parallel to the kinds of things that would have come to the people's mind in Israel when the Lord starts talking about worshiping only him or rejecting the images of the surrounding cultures. And so clearly, with the plain words of verses 4 to 5, that sort of thing would have been prohibited. However, you ever thought about this? that the worship of those pagan idols was actually already prohibited by the first commandment, which is said you're not supposed to worship any other god. And that's one of the reasons we would argue that since the second commandment actually assumes the first one, the second one is not focusing, at least not primarily, on the worship of those pagan gods, but it's actually focusing more on the use of physical idols to worship Yahweh. Now, that would have been a very natural thing that they needed to hear, given the background that they were coming out of. The Israelites had been surrounded by the worship of idols, and so it would have been natural for them to assume that, yes, now Yahweh is their God, but this God of ours would be pleased with the same kind of worship that our neighbors offer up to our gods. They had no other way of processing worship. They had no other context to understand worship, but to approach your God through some kind of idol and doing the kinds of rituals like those other nations did. In fact, is this not what happened when in Exodus 32 they became impatient and they say to Aaron, "Make us a god, because Moses, our God's representative, has apparently disappeared, not coming back." And so what does Aaron do? He makes them a golden calf. And he says to them, "This is your God who brought you out of Egypt." There was just this almost immediate association between whatever God, even Yahweh, and some physical image that represented him, that conveyed to the people his presence, and that they therefore they were to venerate in worship. And so the Lord, here at the outset of it all, is clarifying that he not only is the only God to worship, but also his worship is to be distinctive. It is to be different from the worship of the surrounding countries. Israel should not attempt to worship him by honoring images of him. Or you could put it this way, that the first commandment taught them whom to worship, and the second commandment taught them how to worship him. Or you could even say, more specifically, how not to worship him, because it's stated as a negative. And that brings us to the theme of the message this morning, how not to worship Yahweh. How not to worship Yahweh. And that was, to the Lord, in that setting, such an important topic, such an important burden, that he gives it more attention than he gives to most of the other commandments. I read from verse 4 to verse 6, and those are longer statements than you have for most of the other things that are listed in this chapter. There's so much there, really, by way of background, by way of application, that today we're just going to consider the commandment itself in chapter 20, verse 4, and into the first half of chapter 20, verse 5. And then, Lord willing, we'll come back and look at the rest of the passage next week. Here's what we want to do today. We first of all want to understand what this commandment does not prohibit. Secondly, what the commandment does prohibit. And thirdly, something of how the commandment applies to us today, even though we're going to see more applications, Lord willing, next week. So let's start with the negative, because you really could misunderstand and end up taking a position that is not really what is being expected here. What is it that the commandment does not prohibit? I want you to look at verse 4 a little bit further. It says, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth," period. That's one independent sentence, and it commands the people not to make a carved image or likeness of pretty much anything you can imagine, because what is it that would not be included in heaven above or on the earth or under the earth? Pretty much everything is covered there. You could understand that verse in isolation as actually prohibiting any kind of art, or more specifically, as prohibiting any kind of religious art. And I want to argue that that's not the correct way to understand those words. I want to give you three reasons why. First of all, don't want to understand it that way because of the specific terminology that is used in this passage. It says specifically, don't make for yourself, first of all, a carved image. That is a reference to an object that is carved out of some material like stone or clay or wood or metal that was very well known in that day. And when you look at the way that that word is used consistently throughout the Old Testament, it's not talking about any random piece of art. It is talking specifically about an image that is thought to represent a divine being or something otherwise associated with their idea of the gods. It's not any kind of carving. It's not any kind of carved image. This term is talking about what we refer to as an idol, something that gives you a visual idea of the God that is recognized by those people, that in their way of looking at the supernatural was mediating the presence of that God, and therefore they offer some kind of veneration to that as a way of showing their worship of the actual God. There's also the word likeness here, which is a more general term that doesn't actually show up a lot in the Old Testament, but it does refer to a visible form of anything, and it could be used in a broader sense of any kind of art. But here it is associated, it is linked with that carved image, and it is referring to an alleged deity or the visible form, the likeness of an alleged deity in this particular context. So I would say that the terminology itself is directed to not all art and not even all religious type art, but it is directed specifically to what we refer to as idols. Number two, and maybe even more significant, we don't want to read this as prohibiting any kind of religious art because elsewhere the Lord himself commands the making of religious art. He actually prepares people and commissions people to use their skill to produce works of art that were a part of the overall system of worship that he had ordained. And I'm thinking about what he says regarding the tabernacle. And as a part of making that a beautiful place, and a place that pointed to his own glory, the Lord said this sort of thing. I'm reading here from Exodus 31, starting at verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, "See, I have called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, son of Hur of the tribe of Judah, and I have filled him with the Spirit of God, with ability and intelligence, with knowledge and all craftsmanship, to devise, listen to this, artistic designs, to work in gold and silver and bronze, in cutting stones for setting, and in carrying wood to work in every craft." And I'm not going to go through all the details of what these men created, but you can remember perhaps that the curtains that were used to set apart different sections of that structure, they had certain things woven into them. In fact, even the garments of the priest at the bottom had images of pomegranates. And there were also bells there that produced the sound as well as drew attention to the look of it. There were images of those fruits that were hanging on the vestment that the worship leader used. And then maybe most impressive of all would have been those two golden cherubim. These stunning images of these angelic creatures that were made to sit on the top of the Ark of the Covenant. And in fact, even the Ark of the Covenant was a work of art that represented what? It represented the throne of God. And it was on that part of the tabernacle especially that God's glory descended and he established his presence among the people of God. It was connected with something visual that had been created as a work of art. You can think ahead to other stories in the Old Testament. And remember that in the book of Numbers, in chapter 21, when God was judging his people by sending these venomous snakes to deal with them for their sin and unbelief, how was it that the Lord worked to deliver them from that judgment? He actually commanded Moses to make an image of a serpent. It was made out of bronze, and it was a symbol of God's power to deliver people from the consequences of their sin. And if they would look on that image, divinely appointed artistic rendering of a serpent, and they did so with a heart of faith, looking to the Lord as the deliverer, God would actually heal them. In fact, that became such a potent symbol of God's delivering power and his grace that Jesus would later on in John chapter 3 use it to speak about his own work as he is lifted up on the cross and people look to me in faith, they will be delivered from the ultimate consequence of their sin and not perish. And that was something that was communicated through a work of art. But even that example gets us to the other side, and this is a little bit of a caveat here before we move on. What happened eventually in the history of Israel with that particular serpent image? We find out that about 600 years later, King Hezekiah, among other reforms that he's making, he has to destroy the bronze serpent because the people crossed the line from using this in the appropriate way, which at that point was just a visual reminder of God and his mercy, and they crossed the line from the purpose that it had and actually began to worship the snake itself. In fact, we read in 2 Kings 18:4 that they offered incense up to this image. And so we see something there of the tension here. It can't be inappropriate, it cannot be a problem just to have some kind of artistic form that teaches something spiritually, that teaches something about God, that you associate with truth about him, that he uses to advance his work in your life, but it can devolve into actual idolatry. It can be corrupted, it can be abused, and we need to understand that. In fact, that's the negative side coming up here in just a moment, what is actually prohibited. But clearly, if the Lord himself is commissioning these things, it cannot be in and of itself wrong to have some piece of religious art involved in the work of God. And furthermore, another reason why I don't think this prohibits any kind of religious art would be that this is so closely linked to verse 5. There is a period there, but there is an inseparable logical connection. The whole reason people would make those images in that setting was to worship him, and the Lord just glides right into the statement, verse 5, you shall not bow down to them or serve them. In other words, the purpose of those images was not merely artistic. It was not merely to enhance an environment. It was not merely to teach a lesson. The purpose of the images that are under discussion here was that they were being made to be worshipped. And that was what the Lord was concerned about, which now brings me to what the commandment does prohibit. I've talked about what the commandment does not prohibit, but what does it actually put out of bounds for the people of God? Clearly, the concern is the offering of religious devotion to physical images that were believed to represent deities, and particularly here, that would have been believed to represent Yahweh himself. That's what's being prohibited. The offering of religious devotion to physical images believed to represent the Lord. And that was standard practice in the ancient Near Eastern world. When we studied those plagues, we saw how the Egyptians worshipped creatures in just about every conceivable realm of nature. And we at length considered some of the details and the connections between their gods and the specific plagues. And with that background, you can understand why this commandment is so broad and it is so all-inclusive, because human imagination is such that it can latch onto just about anything. Even a frog, even a dung beetle, and turn it into an object of worship. And so the Lord has to word it very broad, like in case you don't get the point, right? Or in case you're going to be kind of legalistic and limited to just precisely what I'm putting off limits, let me just be very plain. Don't make any images of anything that is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. That covers pretty much everything. You get the message. Do not make images for the purpose of offering them adoration and somehow representing God. Now, I can say that, and we can understand that, but in our Western context, we still struggle to understand why the Lord has to go on and on about this. Because to us, from our perspective, that seems so ridiculous to think that some physical object can actually function as a representative of some transcendent God and somehow receive the worship that you're offering to some spirit being. Why were these people so given over to worshiping elements of nature? And why was Israel so tempted to go down that path? Why does the Lord have to keep dealing with this over and over again? It all seems so strange and so nonsensical to us. And this is where, in order to appreciate what's happening here, we really do have to look at other cultures. We have to broaden our perspective beyond our Western, kind of modern, and kind of industrial and technological society to these other parts of the world where this was so common. Why was it that they practiced this so fervently? What was so attractive to them that they would devise all these complicated ideas and worship systems and kind of center their whole lives around them? Well, we could be here a long time this morning quoting passages from the mouth of these pagan peoples. A little bit of that I did when we were going through the plagues. And so much has been discovered to help us understand what they were thinking. Archaeologists have found inscriptions, they have found the sacred literature of these people that explains what it was that drove them. And I really appreciated the way that a commentator by the name of Douglas Stewart summarized all of this and put it in just about as plain a form as I've ever seen. I want to read for you what he says. And he lists 9 characteristics that made idolatry so attractive to these people. How they viewed it, what they were thinking, and why this was such a snare even to the people of God. Let me read to you these 9 points. Number 1, the first characteristic is that from their perspective, it was guaranteed. In other words, quote, "Ancients assumed that the presence of a god or goddess was guaranteed by the presence of an idol, since the idol partook of the very essence of the divinity it was designed to represent." In other words, this is something they took for granted. That if this was actually a genuine representative of this god, in some sense, that piece of wood or whatever actually partook of the essence. It was a guaranteed thing that was kind of God right there in a small miniature form. Now, you still think that's weird, and I get it, but do you realize that even Western people sometimes have a mindset like that? In fact, even we as Christians sometimes have a mindset like that. If I want to be really close to God, I got to come to a church, right? And somehow there's something unique about these 4 walls that makes it the dwelling of God, and his presence is there in that physical locality, and so I want to feel really close to God, I got to come to that building. Folks, do you realize the New Testament never talks that way? People met in their houses most of the time. And it does talk about the church being the dwelling place of God, but it's talking about the people of the church. Wherever the people of God are, individually our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. Corporately, we're also the temple, but it's in terms of us as people. It's not in terms of a building. And this is part of the, I don't know, carryover of this mentality that we still are somewhat attached to kind of holy places. Now, I've been to the Holy Land, and I would encourage you to take a trip out there sometime. And it's an incredibly illuminating experience to say you've walked where Jesus walked and you have been to places where the Apostle Paul taught or something like this. But I want to assure you that you can be as close to God in your bedroom as you can on the Sea of Galilee. It's not something scripturally attached to a particular physical object or location. And in these people's minds, that is what was going on with those idols. So there was that idea of the guarantee. Number two, and now we're getting more to the point, he says it was selfish. It was a selfish way of thinking about the gods. Quote, "Idolatry was an entirely materialistic system of thinking and behavior, sometimes called the fertility cult, built on the idea that the gods could do virtually anything but feed themselves." And this is true. The gods had all of these powers, but for some reason they had a hard time in the thinking of these people of actually providing for their food and their material needs. The one sort of hold or advantage that humans had over the gods was their ability to feed the gods. Accordingly, it was felt that if one fed a given god, the god was in turn obligated to use his power on behalf of the feeder-worshipper. It was very much of a, I'll scratch your back, you scratch my back mentality. And you're basically using the gods for your own benefit. For whatever reason, they couldn't find food, they got their food from us. If we gave them what they needed, then they were obligated to respond and give us whatever we want. That's the sort of mechanistic, selfish mentality that drove that kind of worship. Number three, it was easy. And Stewart says, frequency and generosity of worship in offering sacrifices were the sole significant requirements of faithful idolatrous religion. In other words, to put it in sort of a Western context, all you had to do for your God was put a little bit of money in the offering. You might say, well, they had to give up a lamb. They had to give up a cow or something. In the extreme form, sometimes they did sacrifice their children. And that would have been very hard. But the point is, as Stewart says, idolatry minimized the importance of ethical behavior. There were no expectations, morally speaking, that those gods were making of you. It was easy in the sense that all you had to do was scratch their back by giving the offering once a week or whatever, and then you're off the hook to do whatever you want. It was easy compared to Christianity, frankly. It just came to my mind a famous statement of C.S. Lewis, who said, "If you're looking for an easy religion, I do not recommend Christianity." Not in terms of what you do to get saved, because that's all by the grace of God as a gift. However, once you've accepted Christ, he is Lord of your life, and he makes total claims on you. And by his Spirit, he begins to work in you to transform you completely. It's not just about showing up and putting a little bit of money in the offering, but that is how these people thought. Number, four now. It was convenient. And what he means by that is that these idol shrines were all over the place. You did not have to do, as Israel was going to be commanded to do, to show up in one place, which meant in some cases you had to travel pretty far to offer your sacrifices and so forth. And God would later rule out all of these high places that were constructed very close by so that you could take care of your obligation to the gods in some kind of an easy way, even in terms of how long it took you to get there and how accessible it was. God actually commanded three annual feasts where the men of Israel were supposed to travel, at least on those three occasions, to the one central location to celebrate the Feast of Israel. It really was not particularly convenient, especially if you live up in Dan or in Beersheba, which is why later Jeroboam says, hey, you don't need to go that far. We're going to come up with our own sort of take on this. And we're going to make these golden calves, like Aaron did, and put them a lot closer to you. so that you don't have to travel that far, making it more convenient like it was the case for these other peoples. Another characteristic, he said it was normal, meaning this is what everyone did and what everyone thought brought success. This was the cultural norm. What was odd is to say there's only one God and you worship him without idols. That was weird. The whole countryside, all nations were worshiping the other way. That is what was normal. And he goes on to illustrate it this way. If an Israelite asked a Canaanite neighbor, how do you farm around here? The Canaanite neighbor probably would start his explanation with a description of how to make proper offerings to Baal and Asherah in advance of preparing the fields and planting or other farm duties in order to ensure the fertility of the farm. Moreover, idolatry was the way of the superpowers and the economically successful states whose riches and prestige seemed to go hand in hand with their idolatrous rites. So you want to be successful, you want to make money, you want to be powerful as a nation, you want to have crops. Everybody, everywhere was telling you, you got to be sure you honor the gods who rule in this particular realm. And that was the normal way of thinking. And so you can get something of the pressure that they felt. It was also logical, Stuart says, from the standpoint of the logic of the ancient cultures. They were polytheistic. And they believed that individual gods ruled over individual aspects of nature. There really was not the idea of one God who ruled over everything. You had to cover all these different bases. And so, of course, you'd want to keep as many of those gods happy as you could. That's the only thing that in their worldview made sense. Here's another characteristic. It was pleasing to the senses. There was a beauty. And as you, again, look at what the archaeologists have uncovered, there was a beauty about ancient temples and images that made them impressive and attractive. Just being in those locations and going through these rites and these people dressed in certain ways, they could lift you out of the mundaneness of life and give you some bit of a feeling of the gods, the other world, transcendence. It was pleasing to the senses. And the last couple things get more serious. It was indulgent. It was indulgent. And this even gets to those sacrifices that I mentioned. These pagan peoples were not like us in many ways, but even in their diet. You're probably going to eat meat twice, and depending on whether you had sausage or bacon for breakfast, you will have had meat probably three times today. And a couple times a day is fairly normal in our society for the eating of meat. Not so much back then. But what happened in this case? If you really wanted meat, you could take an animal, you could take it to your local shrine, you could kill it there, you could cut out a piece for the god, leave that there, you could take the rest for yourself and go have a 4th of July barbecue. There really was this attachment to the physicality of it that it gave you an opportunity to even eat more meat than you normally would. And with that, there was also a lot of drinking of alcoholic beverages and drunkenness that went along with it. It was kind of a big official religious party is what it amounted to. And that brings us to the last characteristic, and that is that ancient worship was erotic. Prostitution was a common practice at these worship sites. And again, you say, that's weird. What does that have to do with it? Well, these people believed in what's been called imitative magic, where what went on in the physical realm supposedly promoted the same or similar activity in the spiritual realm. And when it comes to the growing of crops and the fertility of the ground, that was believed by many to be the product of sexual intercourse among the gods. And how is it that you get them excited and stimulated to have that activity, but to engage in it yourself with these temple prostitutes in the context of worship activities? That was just shot through the entire worship system, particularly of the Canaanites. Now you say, well, that's really strange. And I agree. But again, I'm going to say that wasn't just the ancient world. I want to read to you a little bit from another famous missionary, and her name was Amy Carmichael, and from her biography by Ian Murray. She was really latching onto a statement in Isaiah 49 that even the captives of the mighty shall be taken away, and the prey of the terrible shall be delivered. And they saw a fulfillment of that promise of the Lord capturing some mighty people for the gospel in 1898. Quote, two women broke from their caste system to follow Christ and to join them. The younger had to be sent away for her safety, while the older, a 23-year-old widow, Panamal, joined Amy's band and became an inseparable friend. 3 years later, another addition had special significance. She was a 7-year-old girl, Prina, who arrived where Amy was staying at 6:30 on the morning of March 7, 1901. In Amy's words, her coming, that's this one girl, caused a new thing to begin, and I was rooted for life. And if you remember anything about Amy Carmichael from, I don't know, missionary stories and VBS, you know that she was all about rescuing children from the shrines. What was that all about? This girl had fled from the custody of a temple where she was being prepared, as she was told to be, quote, married to the God. It would take Amy time to learn that the words actually meant a commitment to a life of deified devilry. Integral to the life of many Hindu temples was the presence of temple women, in reality prostitutes trained from childhood to see their occupation as a service to the gods whom they supposedly honored. After Prina had been procured as a child, she had escaped before and walked the 20 miles back to her home. But temple women found her and brought her back to the punishment of having her hands branded with hot irons. On her second escape, the girl had fled for refuge to a church where she was found outside, a very small and desolate mite with tumbled hair and troubled eyes, before being brought to Amy. 50 years later, Prina recalled that morning meeting, our precious Amai, that's Amy Carmichael, was having her morning chota, which is her breakfast. When she saw me, the first thing she did was to put me on her lap and kiss me. I thought my mother used to put me on her lap and kiss me. Who is this person who kisses me like my mother? From that day, she became my mother. And that incident began this whole process that she gave her life to in rescuing their children. She was actually rescuing them from temple prostitution. And she wrote this, we are skirting the abyss, an abyss which is deep and foul beyond description, and yet it is glorified in Hindu eyes by the sanctions of religion. Folks, this is the nature of ancient worship as well. And so it should not be a surprise that, number one, it was so attractive to the people of God, and number two, that the Lord just keeps hammering away at them about not being involved in those kind of idolatrous situations. Now, that really does help me understand why the Lord has so much about this in the Old Testament. And it certainly applies directly to cultures like we just heard, where that sort of worship is common, but we might still be wondering about the application of this for ourselves. And that's what I want to end on this morning. I've talked about what is not prohibited, about what is prohibited, and now number three, how the commandment applies today. Let's think first of all about the ongoing problem of physical idolatry, even in the New Testament. It's not as though when the New Testament opens, all this concern is just set aside. Now, thankfully, by that point, the worship of idols was no longer a significant problem for the people of Israel. And I would assume that that's because through the exile and all those judgments God sent, they had been purged of at least that problem. Now, they had all kinds of other problems. But by the time you get to the time of Jesus, you really don't have idolatry being a huge issue for Jewish people. However, that kind of idolatry that I described was still the norm among the Gentiles of the world. Which is why when you read in Acts the stories of Paul going around the Gentile world preaching the gospel a part of it is to move these people away from the worship of idols and that whole atmosphere that they would have grown up in. Think about the Apostle Paul preaching at Athens in Acts 17, and he is going right at the root of their idolatry when he says, the God just that you've just put up here to cover your bases in case you've missed anyone else, the unknown God, actually, you don't know the real God, and I'm come to declare him unto you. And it's the true God, and he has commissioned his son not only to die for our sins, but he's going to come back and judge you and therefore repent so that you might be saved, delivered, instead of being judged. That kind of evangelism that was very focused on issues of idolatry was needed in the Gentile world. It was also needed when people came out of that and they were saved. If that was their background, you can expect that they would still have issues and hang-ups where they would continually need some encouragement and teaching about how to deal with that, which is why you have a passage like 1 Corinthians 8 to 10. And Paul is urging the people of Corinth, who were Christians, to make a complete break with the idolatry of their past. And he says, look, don't even go in those temples. Even if you're not worshiping, I don't want you in that environment, because what's happening there is idol worship. You don't want to be associated with that. You don't want to be a bad example to anybody. And really, if you happen to find out that some piece of meat that you're going to buy at the market was offered to idols, just stay away from it. Take a totally safe kind of approach, lest in any way you would be encouraging, endorsing that, or leading people in a wrong direction. And so there's a good bit of scripture, both in 1 Corinthians as well as in Revelation, that's all about this theme of meat offered to idols. And there are still cultures today where meat is offered to idols and where the eating of that meat does have those kinds of idolatrous connotations, and there's a very direct connection between that and what Paul is discussing. Furthermore, when it comes to worshiping the triune God, when it comes to worshiping Jesus, what you find in the New Testament is entirely consistent with what is in the Old Testament. You ever thought about this? There's not much at all about the worship gatherings of the people of God in the New Testament. But what is there is very simple in nature. There is no emphasis on the visual. There's really no emphasis on the music. The gathering of the people of God is about edification through the word, the raising up of songs to the Lord, and this emphasis on what we're raising up to the Lord in song. It's got to be true to the doctrine. It's got to be exalting of Christ. And really, the main thing we're doing is we're here to get the word of God. Christianity is a religion, if I could use it that way, of speech, not of sight. It is of words and truth, not of the world of sense and feeling. And the New Testament says little about worship. What it does is to emphasize it's got to be about the word of God, edification, building up. There's no place at all for idols in the New Testament. There is nothing like what you find in Roman Catholicism or in Eastern Orthodoxy of images representing God or Jesus or somebody else that you draw near to in order to pray to them, in order to feel the presence of God. That is non-existent in the pages of the New Testament. And that is as you would expect it to be, because this had been dealt with already in the pages of the Old. Now, we could talk about the problem of physical idolatry that continues to be an issue in some countries and in some religions, but I want to leave you with this, that another way that the New Testament picks up on this theme is by getting us to the heart that drives the physical idolatry. And it's really more along the lines of those characteristics. And I'm thinking especially about what Paul says in Romans chapter 1, which I touched on last time. Verse 21 says, although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Now what's going to happen? They didn't recognize and worship the God of creation. They didn't seek this God who's provided all these wonderful things for them to enjoy. They weren't thankful to him. As they turn away from him, it's like they're turning away from the light of his truth, and therefore they're going into the dark. And the further down that path they go, the darker it gets. And one of the things that they now start doing in the dark is what it says in verse 22, claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. What he's saying is that physical idolatry results from heart idolatry, where you have shut off what you know from creation and conscience about the true God. You don't want to surrender yourself to this God of the universe, this transcendent God. So you walk away from him, but you still have this sense that you're supposed to worship something. And what you do is you find something that's more manageable than the big God of the universe. You take this impulse to worship and you direct it to things in creation, worshiping the creature instead of the creator. And it could take any number of forms. As he mentions here, birds and animals and even creeping things, which sounds a lot like Egypt. One of the things about those gods is that they are gods you can manipulate. And you can come up with all kinds of stories, and you can come up with all kinds of explanations, and you can come up with all kinds of ideas about how you worship that God, or you're supposed to, that end up basically providing ways for you to feed your flesh and do what you want to do anyway. And Paul is revealing that that is what led to the worship of those idols that we have been talking about. Foolish thinking produces foolish people, and foolish people produce foolish worship. Worship that really is ultimately about them being able to play around with this God sense and manipulate it all so that it ends up giving me what I wanted in the first place. And folks, there is such an irony there. God actually, different word but similar concept, God actually already had an image. God made humanity to be his image in the world. And here are these people made in the image of God who are debasing themselves by turning the creation into deity, bowing down before created things, and thinking that this is the way to control my life and my destiny. This is the way to guarantee success and blessing and prosperity. That heart idolatry is what led up to the development of the physical idolatry. And so when the gospel goes out in the New Testament, it is all about turn away from that. That is futile. That is worthless. That's not going to save you in the end. You're wasting your time. I mentioned the Thessalonians last time, that they turned from idols to serve the living and true God. And yet there's more, because verse 10 of 1 Thessalonians 1 says that they also, in turning to the true God, it was to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come. This image of God that we are, Christ is the perfect and fullest expression of it. And the New Testament teaches that he came to earth as the perfect image of God to live like we were supposed to live, to die the death that we deserve, to be raised to life with the power to give us new life so that we could then become the image of God that we were created to be in the first place. When we see the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ, and we see something of the beauty of God's plan of redemption, the glory of his person and work, we will see how unnecessary and how foolish physical images actually are. We already have the image of God. It is Christ in its fullness, and it is Christ's work in us to restore that image in us. God has provided everything that is required, including with all of this teaching telling us how it is that we are and are not to worship him. We're going to come back to this next week as we consider more of the Lord's explanation. But I trust that this has laid a good foundation for us to understand who our God is and how we ought to approach him through Christ. And we want to end this morning by lifting up to him a word of worship And that's the last song, the second one that's on this handout, Worthy of Worship. Dave's going to come and lead us in lifting up these things to the Lord.